resilience is a common theme that seems to stem throughout your life. But I'm curious to start it off, though. Where were you born, brother? Where are you from? Where's your...
Born in Bergen in Norway. Actually, I spent the first 4 years of my life that side of the planet. Parents were teaching and singing and doing various things. Grandfather was involved in London, sort of management capacity. And so, yeah, first 4 years over there and then back to NZ. But NZ parents and, you know, so it's the origin story. Way back
Viking.
In the day.
Yeah, Viking back, blood.
Way back in the day. Yeah, yeah. Bit of Irish blood in there too, I think, somewhere, you know, last name like O'Neill. It's Dungannon up in the north. So yeah. And I've been back to Ireland since, and I got there as well, to go and visit and sort of stand in the place where I feel like there is an echo, an O'Neill echo from way back.
Did you stand out or fit in until you talked?
Or just from my height, I guess I stood out a wee bit. but yeah, absolutely. They hear you talk, and it's obviously the accent, which is amazing. And the further north, I think the more amazing the accent is. I was based in Dublin for a few years, but I went up to sort of Belfast and, you know, places like that, and all the way down to Ballybunion, where again the accent's quite different. But it's amazing, amazing spot.
Yeah, I always think about like brand, like what's New Zealand's brand? It seems to be well received anywhere you go, unless you go to America and they think you're in a state. Oh, what state's that? Like, I've never heard of New Zealand. Is that by a new, like,
you? Yeah, I mean, it's 20 plus years since I traveled. You know, I left New Zealand for my OE in the beginning of 2001. Obviously, that was turned out to be quite a year. And New Zealand does travel very well. You know, I went around Europe and Eastern Europe and things, and the Kiwi passport was, oh, you're Kiwi. Okay, you know, have a stamp. As opposed to some, it's like, well, where's your visa and where's your this and where's your that? So, yeah, and I think that's still the case. I hope that's still the case. I hope my kids get to go and have that same kind of freedom over there.
Yeah, we only got, I think, a little bit of a bad rap because of our lockdowns. But in terms of our, we won't go down that rabbit hole. I don't care. I think there's been a slight change. Like, there's still the rugby thing. There's still the, like, oh, sweet New Zealanders. Then also, you know, he had the whispers of, oh, they were quite strong with the regulation. It's the Americans, especially, they're like, freedom. But anyways, back to you. That is a rabbit hole. I love rabbit holes. I love just speaking whatever everyone else is afraid to. So, okay, what was school like? Was it easy? Were you weird because you had a Norwegian accent? Or?
Oh, no, I'm Kiwi. I'm Kiwi. I was just born in Norway. So I don't think I had any sort of accent at all. Came back with a Kiwi accent and that was that. Yeah, look, I mean, I think the parents were on the way out with the marriage shortly after I was born, and so separated when I was quite young before I started school. So it was a different world back then, right? It's the 70s. And we moved to, my mum and I moved to Auckland, and my dad stayed in Hamilton. He was at Waikato University, and mum decided she wanted to be a professional and have a career and things. So fair play to her. She did that, and I went to boarding school for a few years. I don't know if it was easy. It was a different world back then. Saying to somebody last night, I actually played nine holes with a very old friend from way back in the day, and just saying, you know, obviously it was a different world back then, but they were still the New Zealand cricket team back then. They weren't the Black Caps. Didn't quite know you could make a career out of it and things. So it was a different world. I don't know if school was easy. I enjoyed lots of it. I enjoyed the sports part of it, the music part of it. English and things like that. I'm sure there were some things that I struggled with more than others. That's what happens, though. That's how it goes, right? But yeah, I enjoyed school for the most part.
I took subjects that I was the worst at to try and prove a point.
Oh, really?
English wasn't good for me. I don't think it's a good approach.
Yeah.
Didn't work well. I passed, but well, I've been thinking.
Out the other end. Yeah.
Yeah, I survived. Well, I've been thinking, I was talking to a forensic psychologist the other day because my end goal is to help people live fulfilling lives. And I always look at, like, what's the highest leveraged activity to do that? And parenting If you get the child 0 to 11 and the parents are, you know, a unit and they're supportive and they balance each other out, that's going to do more for the person in their whole life than anything else. The second thing is environment. What do you think the benefit of your parents' separation to your life, like it might have given you a superpower in some component, and what do you think the cost of having an uncertain family dynamic when you're growing up?
It's a pretty deep question there, right?
Welcome to the podcast. This is how I roll, brother. This is why people have buyer's remorse.
Yeah, look, I mean, it was 1976 when my parents, obviously it's different now. I've got an 8 and a 15-year-old boys. I separated from my wife when my youngest was 2, so coming on 7 years, six years ago or so now. Different world that they're growing up in, obviously. I wish I had got a superpower. Spider bit me or something like that when I was real young. I don't think that happened. I think that it sort of started down a road of being pretty resilient, and you know, I was an only child. My dad, who passed two Decembers ago, he remarried, and she had a son who was 5 years younger than me, surprisingly enough, born on the same day. That was kind of weird. And then they had a daughter. So I've got a stepbrother and a half-sister, but I grew up alone. So I didn't have a superpower or anything, but I think that probably taught me a lot about, you know, enjoying my own company and sort of getting on and sort of doing things. And, you know, social media, obviously, way back in the day, go outside and come back when it gets dark and, you know, take a stick and go and build a fort or a dam or something like that down at the river. I don't know if there was necessarily any benefits from it. I suppose on one level there was, you know, 2 lots of Christmas and things like that for a while. I certainly would have felt better, and it's looking back now in my situation as to, you know, the reasons that people split up. I've talked to a couple of people, the clients in the last couple of days, that are going through separations and working through their stuff with that. And there are kids involved. Some are teenage kids, some are really, really young, you know, 2 under 5 type thing. It's a different dynamic, right? And a different world now for those kids to be growing up. And I think that it forces some resilience on you. It forces you to be, you know, depending on your age and things and how you cope with stuff like that. It can be really, really tough. And it also, partly as well as how much the parents are buying in, you know, they're obviously going through a divorce or a separation. That's tough just on an individual level, you know, just going through that is hard. And when things are pretty tough as they are at the moment, you know, whether it's mortgage rates or, you know, cost of bananas or, you know, petrol or whatever it might be, there's a strain on finances. And that adds huge amount of stress, as you know, to anybody, any situation. And the support network around the kids when the parents have split up is so hugely important. And having not grown up with my dad so much, I really wanted to make sure that I was doing everything I could, and I guess on some level not make the same mistakes. It wasn't so necessarily a mistake that he made, but the thing that I wanted to do that he didn't was to show up, was just, you know, how do you be a good dad? You know, well, you know, don't leave. Pretty simple, really, right? I think Ricky Gervais or somebody said something like that and made a joke out of it, but, you know, how do you do it? Well, show up, right? Just keep showing up along with all of your stuff that you might have going on. And everyone's got their stuff going on. So,
yeah come back with the milk. For sure.
Yeah, that's right. Just popping down to the shop. See you in a minute.
That's wild. Yeah. I was talking to that same forensic psychologist, because what he used to do is he'd try to rehabilitate pedophiles, which is a bit hectic. And we don't have to go down that route. But it was something like 80-90% of prisoners come from fatherless homes.
Really?
Yeah. Was stupid. Yeah, and then homelessness, other things as well. So there's some important benefit of masculinity or having a stable environment or having some order in the chaos. So on the side of fatherhood, because, you know, being a human, you'd naturally feel inadequate or you think you're doing it right and then you're not sure and then you learn. What is for these young fathers?
I've got no idea what I'm doing.
Yeah, we're all winging it. Yeah. So what type of winging has enabled, has served you that could help a young father listening to this?
Wow. What have I learned? Well, firstly, show up. Don't give up. Whatever it might be, whatever your situation might have been where your dad or mum or parent or grandparents brought you up because your parents weren't around, whatever that situation or that family dynamic or that family unit might have been, maybe it is up to you to break the cycle. Maybe it is up to you to make a difference. Care more. It's such a small window when they're young. You know, I mentioned the 8 and 15-year-old, both boys. The 15-year-old is, he's 15, right? Phone, girlfriend, football, those are the priorities. It's not me anymore. The 8-year-old, absolutely. You want to play Lego? Yes. You want to play pick-up sticks? Yes, I do. You want to play hide and seek? Again, yes, I do, you know, because that is such a small window before all of a sudden, phone, football, girlfriend, not so interested. So make the most of that time. Know that it's only a small window. And if you have the flexibility to be able to do the pickups and drop-offs, you know, do that for a while. You know, take a hit on some other stuff, compromise, work with your other half, if that's, you know, this unit that you've got, to be able to kind of balance that out, work out a schedule that you maximize that time with them. Have your own stuff as well. You know, I've started playing cricket indoor and outdoor. Again, that's my thing. And I surf a wee bit, which if that was your only hobby, if you live in Wellington, then it's pretty rough. But when the waves are good, they're pretty good. But have your own stuff as well. And make sure you have time for your partner or, you know, the mum of your child, and celebrate them as often as you can. Because absolutely, it's your little team that makes it work. And, you know, I mean, as you mentioned, you know, we're only human and we all make mistakes. And absolutely, that's true. I don't, you know, you don't have to have 1,000, maybe you've got 1,000 Facebook friends, maybe you've got a handful of really good mates. Make sure there's at least one or two of those mates that you can kind of have a deep conversation with about stuff, about how you're feeling. And mental health obviously is huge. Kiwi men and men in general, I guess, are terrible for the most part at sharing or, you know, wearing their heart on their sleeve or just sort of saying, hey, actually, I'm not okay, is talk through that. Because it's those little things that can escalate if they're not talked about or cleared up or resolved, that can then explode and make, you know, it only takes one big mistake to pivot and, you know, the whole direction of your life changes. 90% of prisoners are, as you mentioned, are, you know, fatherless. Mm. Or, you know, from thing, you know, that's not a pivot that you want to have happen. And there's a lot of bad stuff going on in the world, and there's a lot of ugliness and a lot of, you know, all that kind of stuff. It's just trying to remember, I guess, what's important to you. What are you trying to protect? What are you trying to hold on to? What are you trying to grow? You know, and sink as much as you can into your kids. You know, love, tell them that you love them, you know, education, you know, get them to stick with it, like smart choices, all the stuff that you know is right from wrong, you know. And it's little learning things too, because they'll teach you a whole lot of stuff along the way, because they're growing up in a world that you certainly didn't grow up in, the social medias and things like that. So, you know, my 8-year-old can fix my tablet a lot quicker than figure out how I can do it. So, which is great, you know. And everyone's got their own different parenting styles, you know, the helicopter parenting or the tough love parenting, or, you know, whatever you feel works for you. But I guess just keep showing up. Yeah, and don't give up would be my key takeaway.
Seems to be a theme in your life, my friend. Not giving up.
Yeah. I mean, we spoke briefly about, you know, the resilience thing, and, you know, everyone's got their story, right? Like I said, I was catching up with a very old friend. Well, he's not that old, but we've known each other a while. We go back a while. And he invited me out. It was a work, it's sort of a work thing. I look after some work stuff for him. And he plays a bit of golf and invited me out to do 9 holes at a very nice course out in Upper Hutt. And we did, and there was nobody around, not a breath of wind. It was just, you know, it's fantastic. And just catching up with him. And it just reminds me, you know, it was sort of, hey, remember when we did that? Or remember when that? And it was sort of thinking back to 20 plus years ago and what I was like at that time and the things that I didn't know, and what was still to come for me, that I can look back in hindsight and go, wow, you know, I made it through there. I never thought I would. You know, there's some There's some snapshots of time, events that happen in your life, and you go, you remember being in them and going, God, I'm never going to get out of this. This is the worst thing in the world. And yet here we are.
Mm.
What changed? What did you learn from those things? And what can you pass down? What can you try and not push down and bottle too much, but you know, talk through and resolve and learn from, and then pass on some of that resilience, personal resilience training, is that a thing, onto your kids as well, so they can kind of see how strong you can be and how strong you know, and talk to them about the things that you went through, so they can go, oh wow, that was really tough, and you made it through, so maybe I'll be okay as well. Yeah,
we used to call it in sales training like war stories. So my train every, well,
yeah,
I'd say it every time to, so I was training someone and they'd be suffering, some struggle, haven't got their sales at a certain period of time and it seems insurmountable. And I would just say, this is a war story for the moment that someone you train needs this experience that you're building. And you think about any trait that you admire in someone had to come from something that might not be good. Like patience, you need to wait for what you want. Resilience comes from facing adversity and still going forward. So how do you balance that as a father, like wanting to protect them, but knowing that comes at the expense of their development?
Thankfully, there's plenty of books and plenty of podcasts and things and TED Talks and whatnot that you can watch, read, absorb around how to do what you do. I don't know what that balance is, Ryan. I think I'm totally winging it. You know, I'm learning as I go. I'm trying to just be a good person, you know, not be a be somebody that my kids can be proud of, I guess. And I know there's going to be compromises and things along the way. It's the way it goes. Their development, I think, is... you know, for the 15-year-old, it's different. He's kind of now developing a little bit more on his own. He doesn't need me in the same kind of capacity. And for the 8-year-old, absolutely. I try to find that balance by just asking lots of questions. You know, how is, you know, pick the kids up, and the youngest especially, you know, how was your day? You know, what was good? What was bad? What was frustrating? You know, what was the best part about it? You know, what are you looking forward to tomorrow? You know, always kind of growing and thinking ahead and thinking positively. Entering on the side of positivity wherever possible. I'm a hopeless optimist, you know. I know it's not lost to me everything that's going on in the world, and I see it and I talk about it and I, you know, all that kind of thing. But I do try to err on the side of positivity, and I try to, that's, I guess, where it maybe not the balance for the kids, but where I can really find where they can hopefully find some strength is knowing that, you know, you work hard and all the rest of it, then you're probably going to be okay. You know, good things happen to good people. Occasionally there are accidents and occasionally there are bad things that happen, but for the most part, you know, good things happen to good people. And if you work hard and are a good person, then chances are things are going to, you know, things are going to work out okay. I have to believe that. I want to believe that. I think I need to believe that, because otherwise it's all doom and gloom and, you know, oh, the world's coming to an end, or this is bad, or this is bad, and never gets any better, and now it's raining again, and, you know.
So. Yeah. Well, personally, I think the biggest gifts, the biggest challenges or suffering or hardships in my life have always been the greatest gift, because very rarely will you change. Like, there's a story of a dog. I don't know if you heard Tony Robbins' story. Have you heard the story of the dog sitting on the front of the deck?
I haven't. I know Tony, but I haven't heard the dog story. No, do tell.
So the dog has his favorite spot every day. It sits there, perfect amount of wind, perfect amount of sun. And then all of a sudden there's a nail that's bent where he usually sits. He sits on it, keeps sitting on it, keeps howling, complaining, never changes. To the point where the pain of the nail gets so great that he has no choice but to change. So that's what I love about those moments, is where, like, for example, girl left me, got with another guy, moved 200 meters down the road. So every time I wake up, I'd sit from my bedroom door. And then 80% of the staff got fired. So, and it was commission only. So I had no one booking me appointments, and my rent doubled, and I was sleeping in my car, and my friend tried to kill themselves, and I had no other friends. So I was like, oh, well, this sucks. But then it highlighted in my life that there's a lot of things wrong. I don't like my job. I don't have any hobbies. I don't have a fulfilling connections. All right, well, existing's pretty painful. Might as well fix it. So what has been your lessons from resilience or from hardship?
So that's a good story. It's a scary story. That's not a good story, Ryan. Is that something that happened? This is to you, or this
No, I didn't make it up.
Okay. Well, I won't make this up, but let me tell you a story. So prior to the financial sort of career that I've pivoted and taken, you know, a whole bunch of years doing this, a bunch of years at KiwiBank prior to that, I had some time overseas, as I mentioned, and prior to that, I had about 20 years, close to 20 years in radio, which was kind of my first love. From the late 80s, I sort of got a spark and found that was going to be my thing. Anyway, towards the end of 2008, we were living in Hatate, my then partner to be my wife, and she was pregnant with my eldest, now 15, and my mum came to visit, and I looked out the window and I saw her parking her little Toyota Echo, and she got out and she kind of stabilized herself, and I thought, oh, that's you know, it's just a bit odd. You just notice something, you go, well, it seems a bit odd. And Ethan was born in December of 2008. I was made redundant from my radio job, which then closed that chapter, in February of 2009. And mum died of aggressive pancreatic cancer on April 2nd of 2009. So that, and again, you go through something like that and you think, you know, how am I going to get through this? I remember Wellington Hospital, the maternity ward, with you know, Ethan being born and things, which was, you know, greatest moment of my life, you know, 1:20 Tuesday morning, December 9th. Still remember it, snapshot here. But I remember the corridor in Wellington Hospital that has those flickering lights, the what do they call those ones? The long tube lights.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I don't know what it's called. Yeah.
Not, they don't all work, you know.
Yeah, we made it.
Tunnel, right? And it goes
for horror movies.
Good for horror movies. Yeah. And it had the maternity ward at one end, and then I'd walk down to and go up the lift in the oncology ward and see mum. And I remember that, and I remember stopping more than once in the middle and just sinking to my knees. Yeah, in the middle of that corridor. Just the fighting that, you know, there's such joy at one end and such pain and things at the other. I look back now, of course, and she got, you know, 4 months or so with him before she passed. You know, so that was, I guess, a highlight. Not a highlight, but, you know, a silver lining. Having been made redundant in February, I then got a couple of months, not having to worry about work, but I could concentrate on seeing her, take my guitar over and, you know, sing to her and talk about stuff and tell her things that she never knew, that I figured, well, if now, then when, you know, on some level. She suffered no falls, so it was never going to be April 1st that she held on for another 24 hours and went at April 2nd. But we moved from Wellington up to Palmy. I went to restudy, become an adult student, bought a leather jacket and a motorbike and, you know, did all of that kind of stuff before moving back to Wellington and things. But, you know, that whole period from that kind of November to kind of May, June was just, it was like when you watch a movie and somebody gets a cancer diagnosis and everything, just white noise, that kind of, you know, and it felt like that whole period was just that kind of white noise. I can remember snapshots of it, but I can't remember too much. Anyway, so I come back from Palmerston North and went to an assessment day at KiwiBank and never looked back. So I guess that was, you know, a period of time where I had to be resilient. You know, I had, I'd been made redundant and had a new baby, and the part was obviously, you know, off work, maternity leave and things, and I needed to, you know, kind of reshuffle and retrain and get some more direction and change the way that things were going. So that taught me a lot of resilience through that period. And I look back now and think, how did that happen? How did they get through that? And again, it wasn't just me that was involved, you know. There was a wider family support. There were a handful of mates that I could kind of talk to about that kind of stuff, who knew everything and knew me well before that, so kind of knew the type of person I was and how I potentially deal with that, and checked in on me and made sure I was okay. And that ended up being a really, really important time.
Yeah, you hear some horrific chats. I mean, maybe I won't go into I've just heard so many horrific stories lately. They're just like out the gate where you just say this human's degree of suffering is remarkable. But I mean,
everybody's done it though, right? Everyone's got their story. That's one of mine, and it's not the worst thing in the world. You know, it was pretty bad. I mean, losing a parent, it sucks. Losing your mum extra sucks.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you know, you can look back and go, it's all part of that circle of life and things. And, you know, I'm getting on a little bit more now. I still feel great and, you know, work hard to still feel great and be present and involved and energetic and all of that kind of thing. But it's just, that's the way it goes, you know. And I've got friends that have, people I know that they've taken their own lives. I know people who have got really sick and not come out the other end really young, like, you know, late 30s, early 40s. That's young. I know people now that I've known for 25 plus years that have always been great and have now got a cancer diagnosis or have got something, have lost a child. I mean, talk about the worst thing in the world, put it out to the universe, you know, that kind of stuff going on. So everyone's got their own stuff. Everyone's got their story, good and bad.
And I find just like me, yeah. I find everyone's got pretty similar emotions just for different reasons. So it's like you see this divide of wealthy, not wealthy, this color, that color, this religion, that religion, this politician. And I think the challenge is like if someone's in that position where they feel down and they're not happy, usually the mental mind map they use is, it's different for me, you wouldn't understand. And that isolates them further. What do you find with the men that you're talking to that, you know, might not open up that easily? And how do you actually encourage men to have more vulnerable chats with each other? Or why do you think they're not?
Why do you think they're not? I think that's probably its own podcast to kind of dive into that one. As to why that's going on, I think it's systemic right through generational, not only in New Zealand, but obviously all around the place. If they're not talking to me, then I'm just not the person that they should be talking to. It's more around encouraging them by sharing your own story. I think it's important to show that, you know, it is okay. It's healthy to talk about it. And some have got real, I've got a really good friend who's not great at talking, until he's had a few drinks and then he opens up a little bit more. But, you know, it's just around creating that safe environment, I guess, and a timing thing for people as well. You know, a lot of time, I guess, you know, encouraging them to talk, sharing your own story, like I say, is important, but they've got to feel like it's the right time for them to open up or to share something or to talk about something. So I think it's just making sure that, as mentioned at the start, you know, you're checking in on a friend. It's not just a call once a year, you know, hey, mate, happy birthday, or, you know, what are you up to for Labor weekend, you know, something like that. It's every couple of weeks, or, you know, it's flicking a text. Hey, mate, it's just thinking about you. Hope all's okay. You know, it's that regular check-in, I think, is more important than just a kind of a, you know, helicopter. Oh, g'day. Hey, Ryan, haven't seen you in a while. Hope all's well, mate. You know, things are good. Because then it's a superficial conversation, right? Yeah, no, I'm fine. Thanks for asking. You know, whereas actually under the surface, maybe not quite so fine.
God, that hope all is well trigger. Like, do you really hope it's all well?
Yeah, I know, right? Yeah, somebody said, I heard somebody. It's like when you're asking somebody, it's like, you know, instead of how are you, it's you know, how are you today? Yeah, And there's a Norwegian saying, actually, ippe oppe grata, which is up and not crying, which is a great, you know, how are you? Well, I'm up and I'm not crying. This is a good thing. You know? Yeah. That's I think just the regular check-ins is key there, Ryan, is to make sure. And there are lots of vulnerable people out there, that don't look vulnerable, that have a shield up or have a wall up and things, and use humor or whatever it might be to kind of mask things. And I guess it's how well you know them or as to what kind of conversations you can have with them. But I guess just encouraging them. And when I'm saying this, I'm thinking, I haven't perhaps been fantastic in talking to my mates recently about some of the stuff that, you know, we're going through, I'm going through and whatnot. And I need to reconnect as well, because I know that I can as well. And I guess that's part of it too, right? If you've got some history with somebody or you've just got a connection with somebody, male or female, you know, you can have great friends that are girls that you can have these same kind of conversations with. And obviously they bring a different angle to whatnot. But just guys talking to guys, you know, it's all about timing, but it's just about knowing that it's okay to share.
I think the most shocking thing that I've found with having these chats, because, you know, I'm a deep kind of guy that probably stems from abandonment issues. So the more I can understand someone, the less likely they're going to abandon me. So I always ask deep questions to understand them. But the more I talk to people, the more shocked I am at how few people actually know them, who they really are and how they really feel. And even like it's like crack. Like if you're vulnerable with someone and they accept you, it's a degree of satisfaction and fulfillment that I haven't compared to anything ever. So if it feels so good and it is so great, and yet people are choosing not to, because they've developed this mental framework of, let's say when they were young, their parents weren't there for them, so they had to self-soothe, so they're avoidant in relationships. So when presented with suffering, they withdraw and separate themselves. When in actual fact, what they need is the opposite of the experience they had as a child, which is a nurturing, loving, accepting, and they share. So what do you think is causing such fractured relationships, if it is true, if it feels so good, and we all sort of know we need to do it, why the fuck aren't we doing it? Or why haven't you did it in the past?
Well, it's the other side, isn't it? Yeah, I mean, it's the other side of that. It's if I do and it doesn't work, then, you know, I'm embarrassed or I'm humiliated or they're going to go and tell people about what I've said or any number of things such as that. So you're right, it does. It feels great. You find the right person, you share, or you can just be vulnerable or be yourself. It's an amazing feeling, unbeatable. Like you say, can't compare it to really anything else, right? It's love, you know, sharing something with somebody that you know could destroy you, and they choose not to destroy you. You know, that's real love, right? It's hard to find, and harder to find these days when it's all swipe right, swipe left, swipe right.
Super like.
So yeah, I don't know. I think the reason why people don't is, I mean, it's generational. People have grown up with their dads never sharing, never saw dad cry, you know, never saw this. He was always out in the shed chopping wood or doing something, you know, fixing the lawnmower. You know, so I'm not going to do that. I'm going to let my dad see me do that, or certainly not anybody else, you know. So, because then if it doesn't work, or, you know, I'm going to feel silly and I don't want to feel silly. So I shut down to avoid that.
Mm. I use like a gym analogy to explain it. I think the problem isn't expressing the vulnerability, it's how long they wait until they do it. So say, for example, you go to the gym and first day you bench 200 kilos, you try to. You get wrecked. Whereas if you turned up every day and you just did the bar to start with, warming up, getting the technique right, practicing it, and then you get reinforced, oh, actually, this is fine, I don't get hurt. And I think that's how people approach relationships and vulnerability. So it's like you're swiping on Tinder. Let's say you're a fuckboy and, you know, emotionally distant fuckboy because some girl hurt your feelings. So now you're just having meaningless sex with lots of women. And you're swiping. And then finally you're like, oh, I really like this girl. I'm going to invest in her. So you've been emotionally distant with every other relationship up until then. And then all of a sudden you're about to bench 200 kilos and you become this gargoyle, like this pathetic sort of needy, like constant need for reassurance. And after she got the prize of convincing this fuckboy to settle down, now she realized, oh my God, he's got deep rooted insecurities and he lashes out and he's jealous. I think the problem is that people wait for it to be safe instead of doing small vulnerabilities with better outcomes. Because if you train your brain each time you do something, it positively reinforces it. It's like if you're walking down the street, like social momentum. Let's say you're a nervous person. Instead of going up to a girl and like, hey, I love you, will you marry me? That would be pretty scary, even for me, now that I've done a lot of time. But if I walk down the street and I started with eye contact, and then I walked down to the next person, I just smiled at them. And the next person, I said hi. And it built. And then what it did is it conditioned my brain to think, when I do this, it's okay, I get this. So my theory is people need to stop benching 200 kilos. What are your thoughts?
I love that. That's a great analogy. And I can imagine you walking down and just doing the blue steel look to people as you're walking past.
Anything that works.
Yeah, that's great. Sure. Look, I often think in more cases than just meeting people too, and in solving problems and being vulnerable as bite-sized chunks, right? It can be quite overwhelming to think of the things you've got to get through or to meet people or how do I connect. Bite-sized chunks, absolutely. Put yourself out there and give it a go. Start off with the bar and you'll be at 200 kilos before you know it.
Yeah. Well, there'll be something I wanted to talk about. It's probably another heavy chat, but there's a movement called Men Going Their Own Way. I don't know if you've ever come across it.
No.
You're probably lucky. No offense to them. But basically, they get wrecked by some girl financially because of a separation or, you know, cheating, affairs, all this, and they just close off. And they're like, I'm just going to go my own way.
Right.
Because the marriage is wrong. So how do you keep hope in the face of a tragic end in a relationship? Or how is a man in a separation? Do you keep chugging along or do you not? Have you gone your own way? You're part of the group that you didn't know.
Yeah. How do you stay strong in a separation? Well, it's hard to do that because when you're in it, and again, you can look back and go, I made it through that. You know, and it was 6+ years ago that, you know, the marriage came to an end. I'm with somebody new now who just as means the world to me and I mean the world to her, which is a really nice position to be in. She's now obviously co-parenting as well, which is a huge thing. I think when you're in it, how do you not give up? Yeah, I mean, I haven't heard about men going their own way, but even just the name kind of creates this. Yeah, I can imagine. I hope that's not a real anti-female or anti-woman thing, because that would be a shame. But I think, how do you? Yeah, I have a friend who split up from his wife as well, and I remember his Facebook post was, you know, just a black screen and, you know, dark situation. When you're in it, it's really tough. I think, again, is, you know, take that time to have your time to go through it, fall into the grief, you know, lean into that and let yourself be vulnerable to yourself. You know, if you got to, you know, sink your face into your pillow and cry yourself to sleep for a couple of nights, nothing wrong with that. It's very therapeutic. Let the tears out. But I guess, you know, stay strong, don't give up, keep showing up, be present. And certainly if you've got, you know, if there are kids involved as well in that separation and stuff, it makes it extra hard, you know, extra hard, especially if it's like week about, you know, a week you don't have them, you miss them and you miss your old life. And what am I going to do and how am I going to get through this? You know, I remember being in my first rental after we had to sell the house and rehome my dog, which was, that really sucked. But I remember putting the boys' bunk beds together, a little Allen key, you know, and I couldn't get the Allen key in. My hands were shaking and I think I had a panic attack and, you know, I was not in a good state, you know. At the time, how am I going to get through this? When you're actually through it or knowing that, you know, I'm going to be okay. You know, that sucked. You know, what can I learn from it? You know, was it me? Was it them? Was it us? Was it, you know, what were the factors that created me now being by myself? Or did I actually create this because this is actually what I wanted? I wanted to be by myself, and now I am where I want to be. Different things for different people, right? I guess the key is don't give up. Don't know that you're not alone. There are plenty of online groups. There are plenty of meetings you can go to at various places where you can, and phone calls that you can make to helplines that can kind of just be an anonymous soundboard where you can vent and get a different angle or a different way of thinking about something, or at least talk to somebody like one of those helplines where they go through it all the time and they can go, hey, look, in my experience, this is what I've found can work. And these guys will have, you know, things that can help different individuals.
Yeah, it's quite, from the mental health standpoint, I think that's probably, from at least from my experience talking to men, that's number one reason why they commit or think about suicide is relationship. And I think what it highlights is how much of their life is lacking, how few people know them and they have a vulnerable connection with, how unfulfilling their work might be, and how they build a life around this person and then all of a sudden this person's gone. And how they often deal with it is to blame that person. And I never really understood blame. It's like giving them power over you. And it's turning yourself into the bully. So it's like, okay, someone calls me a name an hour ago. I go home. I look in the mirror. I'm like, fuck that guy. Fuck him. But I'm just like over and over. So they're not even there. Whose fault is it now? Like, it's just me bullying me. Like, only emotions only last 5 minutes. If you want to keep them going, you can. You just keep thinking about them. So
it depends what you're going to surround yourself with too, though, as well, right? Because if you're going through and you're in a dark space or down a rabbit hole and are feeling bad, then that stuff's going to linger, and somebody calling you a name an hour ago is going to sit with you for 24 hours. But if you're in a good space or you're heading somewhere, you know, you're going for a surf or something this afternoon or whatever, it's like talk about, you know, being on the way to, you know, you going through a car park and I cracked my shin on a tow bar. You know, I was walking through some cars in the supermarket, and on a bad day, you'd be like, oh man, that hurts and it's going to hurt for ages and it stings and all the rest of it. But if I do that and I'm on my way for a surf, then it's like, oh man, that hurt, that sucks. Oh well, into the water. You know, it's about where you are and what you're surrounding yourself with and how you kind of put yourself out there.
Yeah, I mean, I use that in sales. It's like people need to stay consistent with the identity that they're in that moment. So it's like if I'm in a negative state of mind, or let's use an example, if I'm arrogant or I'm shy and I walk down the street and someone looks at me, if I'm arrogant, I'm like, fuck yeah, I look good. If I'm shy, I'm like, oh my God, something's wrong with me. It's just like you've got this identity that's looking for confirmation, and that's why that negative experience. I approach it more from a process standpoint. So I'm big into meditation, and I see anxiety or negative thoughts like a snowball. It catches pace as it rolls down the hill. Or another example is your thoughts are like a river. You can get into the river and get washed down and continue looking for reaffirmation of your negativity, or you can observe it as it passes. So I'm a big, and if you want to understand what observing as it passes means, it's like, it's hard to think when you're observing something. So instead of, you're not thinking of the words, the meaning, you're just thinking like, let's say we're looking at the screen. I'm just thinking about the screen. It doesn't mean anything. I'm just looking at it. Oh, it's slightly purple. You know, there's some white at the top. You know, it says we're at 44 minutes. I'm just looking at that while the river's passing. So I think I look at it more process. And anytime I get caught up in that, you know, fuck them, but, you know, it's like, oh, just bang my shin again and I'm off. I definitely do it, especially road rage. There's some retard just like, oh, not aware.
It's got worse too. Not about where you're at, but I used to love driving. I don't look forward to it quite as much as I used to. There's a lot of aggression out there on the roads.
That's huge. What do you, Nah, well, I mean, I think it's the state of mind will be a contributing factor.
But
what I was gonna say something around that, but yeah, what do you think of this?
It's really good. It's taking you a long time to get to that place to be able to sit on the side of the river as opposed to falling in or just being in the river.
Yeah, I find that the time I'm in the river is shortening. So I still get caught up and stuff, get upset.
Yeah, of course.
So it's usually abandonment issue. If someone's behaviors changes and I don't understand why, then I'll just start making up this massive story about it. And then, I'm in the river again. Well, we get out of the river. Because if I don't understand what's happening, then I'll just assume they're going to leave me. That would be my emotional reaction. So I'm just more conscious of that. But I'm wondering what you think of projections, because I believe almost any strong emotion you feel about someone is a projection. And not many people agree with that. But like if someone calls me a purple dinosaur, it's insulting. Do I get upset about it? No. But if someone says, I don't know, I don't feel safe around you, or you're cruel, or you're a bully, that hits me and I get an emotional reaction. So it's not them, it's me.
Yeah. Yeah.
What do you think?
Wow. That's, I hope that's not happening for you, because that's not a very nice thing to hear from people.
Oh, they don't feel safe.
Like that.
Not that one, not often. Maybe.
But you're a purple dinosaur.
Oh, yeah, yes, no, that's tough. Yeah, Barney. Yeah, Barney.
I was going to say Barney. I'm thinking the Wiggles thing. Oh, no. We just go down the track. So what's the question?
What are your thoughts on every strong emotion you feel towards a human being is probably some story from before them?
Oh, yeah. If you've been alive long enough, absolutely it is. Yeah, absolutely it is. And it takes a certain kind of strength as well to realize in that moment, if you want to be beside the river or jump in, right? And that comes through that resilience, that comes through the meditation, it comes through a bit of life lesson, you know, worldly kind of understanding. And also, as you get older, you care less about what people think, depending on what your priorities are. So it doesn't affect you quite so much anymore. Absolutely. If somebody's, I mean, the same thing with work, right? We're doing the right thing for our clients and having the right conversations. And, you know, I sometimes, I guess, think about if I'm going to call somebody, I haven't talked to them in a while, or I'm calling on behalf of somebody else at work, you know, what's their reaction going to be when I answer? So I try and do all of this prep and all of this information as much as I can first. For any possible contingency or any possible question they could ask, I'm kind of ready, or it's at my fingertips. And then I'll call them and they go, oh, look, now's not a good time. Can you call me back next Tuesday? I'll go on. I did all of this work and now you don't want to talk, you know. So that's a projection, I'm sure, of my insecurities around making sure that I want to do a good job. I want to be seen to be, you know, working in the best interests and for my clients and successful and things like that. Whereas actually, yeah, they don't care. They just like, oh, okay, yeah, nice to hear from you. Yeah. Call me next week. I haven't had anyone call me a purple dinosaur or say anything too mean like that.
Lucky.
But in saying that, people, you know, 15-year-old teenage boy, you know, is going through everything that a 15-year-old teenage boy goes through. And when you're not with the mum and you have, you know, you're co-parenting and doing your best to keep that, then absolutely there are things that, you know, there are clashes that happen. There are things that happen. It's just the way it goes. I think that it sounds like you're doing a lot of work on yourself to make sure that you're going to be in a good position if that happens again. I don't know if I agree or disagree with that. I think that there's absolutely some truth in it. I think that becomes less and less a problem as you get older. And again, it all depends on the support network that you've got around you as well, right? And the things that are important to you and what you want to try and protect.
Bomb. Well, great way to end the podcast. So thanks for coming on.
Thanks for your time, Ryan. Good luck to you, mate. Well done.